Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. Visit www.morantechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE, and on this podcast, we feature a keynote address from the EDUCAUSE 2011 Midwest Regional Conference. Our presenter is Sally Jackson, Chief Information Officer and Associate Provost for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her presentation is entitled, Got Connections?
Thank you, Debbie. Thanks so much, Debbie, and to all of you for being here this morning. Gee, badgers are so impressive, and wouldn't want to mess with them. Nearly 3 years ago, my colleagues and I started on a path toward trying to transform IT support to match changes in 21st century academic work. And we didn't have a clear analysis at that time of how academic work was changing, but we knew that it was changing dramatically. One overall tendency of information technology has been to amplify people's ability to connect with resources and people all over the world. And behavior has changed as a result of that. It isn't, as Michael Wesch pointed out, technology is not just a tool, but something that has the capacity to change how we relate. And that happened as we brought more technology to the university. And it's now our task to try to adjust our own behavior to match the practices that have shifted as a result of the growth of our capacity to connect. Research and teaching and learning have all changed quite dramatically. And in ways that challenge our ideas about support in unexpected ways. Across many, many fields, academic work is becoming more interdisciplinary, much more international, more cross-institutional, and more connected across boundaries in every way that we can imagine. And as these changes accelerate, some of our support practices are becoming less and less viable. So it's time for us to try to re-examine them and try to figure out how do we ourselves have to adjust to the changes in practice that we see all around us. One thing that's really easy to see is the enormous increase in the importance of virtual organizations. Virtual organizations are groups that form without all of the things that we associate with conventional organizations, common reporting structures, common payroll, common workplace, and so on. And in professional definitions of virtual organizations, the use of cyber infrastructure or other technology-mediated communication usually figures as one of the components. And what we see going on in the sciences is a huge increase in the size and complexity of collaborations made possible by virtual organizations among scientists themselves. You may find very large groups of people working together on a common data set, on a common instrument, on a common project, and many of these people may be strangers to one another. Now, the hardest part of thinking about how to reform our support practices is getting enough distance from our past and from even our present in order to be able to really think about things in a new way. If we take out a blank sheet of paper and try to think about what should IT support for the 21st century look like, I have a pretty good idea of what many of us will do. I know what I did when I tried to do this in a recent exercise. You begin by thinking about the services that we provide now. And right away, you think, oh, it would be really fabulous to just dump a lot of the services that we have and replace them with really great new ones. And so we all have some capacity to think about how things should be if we start with a blank sheet of paper. But I suspect that not very many people would start by questioning whether the whole idea of a service catalog might be the thing that we need to replace, whether we need instead to start thinking about how we can imagine support apart from the services that we ourselves provide. Now, that sounds a little bit far out, I know. I hope by the end of this talk it'll sound less far out. I'm not suggesting that we throw out our service catalogs, because they're really important in helping us to think clearly about what we're doing and what people expect of us. But a blank sheet of paper isn't that much better than one we've scribbled all over if we can't actually go at it with a completely open mind. And what I'm going to suggest is that we try to get some distance from our past and our present by actually making an imaginary journey to a faraway place where designing 21st century support isn't a thought experiment, but a real exercise going on right now. Let's go to the Eastern Mediterranean, to Cyprus, a small island nation. Drawn a circle, I've highlighted it here for you to spot it. Where a true 21st century enterprise is coming to life right now. The Cyprus Institute is a brand new research center created in about 2005, so it literally didn't exist in year 2000. But that's not why I call it a true 21st century enterprise. The reason it's a true 21st century enterprise is because of the way it's organized. And the first feature that it has that I will assert is distinctive of 21st century research is that it's massively interdisciplinary, massively and radically interdisciplinary. Instead of being organized as a set of colleges and departments the way our universities are, Cyprus Institute is organized as research centers dedicated to very challenging problems. In the lower left, you can see the Energy, Environment, and Water Research Center, and its mission is to try to solve problems related to adaptation to global climate change. So that's its organizing principle. Anything from any discipline that can help us understand how humans can adapt to global climate change might find its way into the EEWRC. And the Science and Technology and Archaeology Center is organized around the task of trying to preserve world culture in the face of all of the challenges that we now are experiencing, and the role of technology in doing that. How does world culture survive the changes in behavior that surround our new technologies? Now, an interesting thing about this is that it changes how we sort people within the organization. An economist might be in any one of these centers. In fact, there will probably be economists in all three of these centers and in the six others that are planned. And Cyprus Institute has just gotten over the idea that there's something wrong with having economics here, economics there, and economics in another place. They realize that an economist working on global climate change is not doing the same work as an economist working on cultural preservation. So that's an important feature of 21st century work, a changed idea about how we sort people, whether around disciplines or around something else. And each of the three centers exhibits a second characteristic that I'll assert is characteristic of 21st century academic work. And that is, they are international. In fact, they're radically international. Each of the three centers has global connections with world-renowned institutions as sort of their anchor partners, and then a growing list of other partnerships from all over the world. So here I've shown you a very small network diagram of the EEWRC with some of its principal partners. Its major institutional partner is MIT, and a second partner, the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry. And then there are a bunch of other partnerships around other specific things that have to do with climate change. The Archaeology Center, what they call Star C, has as its primary partner a very prestigious museum research center headquartered at the Louvre. But they also have other partners, such as the Italian Ministry of Culture and a number of others. And again, a shifting and growing list of partnerships. I'll point out just one of these partnerships, the New Library of Alexandria. You're going to see it again in a moment. The third center is the one that's of most interest to me. They call it Castor C, that's Computation-Based Science and Technology Research Center. And it's of most interest to me because that's where we have our partnership. Illinois is the primary partner for Castor C. And because of the links through the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, one of the things that Castor C will do is run a high-performance computing center, not only for all of the centers of the Cypress Institute, but also for other interests within the Eastern Mediterranean region. They've built up a really impressive list of partnerships. The Jülich Supercomputing Center, PRACE, which is the partnership for advanced computation in Europe, and others. And here, too, you'll see that there is a connection to the New Library of Alexandria. There is computational work being done to support the digital efforts of the New Library of Alexandria. Now, one of the things I want you to see here is that although these three centers are geographically co-located in Nicosia and Paphos, their primary ties, their closest ties, are actually to global partnerships. MIT is closer to the Energy, Environment, and Water Center than Castor C is, even though they share a building. Now, that's a very important point. Something very, very distinctive of 21st century organization. It's international, it's indifferent to distance. Now, here's how my network visualizing tool reorganizes the data when I put all three centers together with their shared administration. This visualization shows the three centers still having their separate connections, but there are pairs of connections where two centers are cooperating with the same project. For example, the EEWRC and Castor C are both involved in a project called Sesame, a really interesting project that's trying to figure out how to create processes that'll simultaneously generate electricity and do water desalinization. And that's a very ambitious idea and involves both the expertise of the center concerned with the environment and the advanced computational resources of Castor C. Castor C and Star C share a connection to the New Library of Alexandria, each doing different work with the New Library of Alexandria, but sharing that as a link and as a common set of connections. Now, the last characteristic that I want to point out about Cypress Institute is that its faculty tend to be associated in multiple places. That is, somebody on the payroll at Cypress Institute might also be on the payroll at MIT, or not on the payroll at MIT, but working at MIT. They might be on the payroll at Illinois or at NCSA, or not on the payroll, but working at Illinois or NCSA. Or at Toronto, or at Tel Aviv, or at any of the other places with which Cypress Institute is partnered. And the same thing is true for students. This characteristic is one that we've pondered at great length at Illinois. People are refusing to be contained in organizations now. We've given them the technology to connect with multiple organizations as though the organization is simply part of their social network. And they're taking advantage of that to connect to multiple institutions at once. So this third characteristic is inter-institutional and cross-institutional. 21st century organizations must be prepared for people who want to work cross-institutionally and inter-institutionally, people who refuse to be contained within any organization at any scale. So the Cypress Institute is designed for work that's interdisciplinary, international, and interinstitutional, three core characteristics of where things are heading for academic work. And that's what I want you to see from this particular visualization. I had the chance to visit Cyprus Institute recently in January with Kevin Maroney, the CIO at Penn State. And we went with a very specific mission. We were asked to try to help the Cyprus Institute build, almost from a blank sheet of paper, the IT support that they'd need for these three centers and for another six that are planned to be added to the Cyprus Institute in the future. That's a photograph of their principal library building. You can see that it's in construction. This is a brand new enterprise. And for Kevin and me, this was, you know, a real-life opportunity to think about IT organization as though from a blank sheet of paper, and that was very, very instructive for us. We realized, for example, that we have many, many practices in our own organizations that are based on an idea that our people are contained within our organization, and that what we need to do is provide the right experience inside the container. Well, that's not really true. We were both drawn to the Cyprus Institute through one individual, a professor named Lucas Kalasperis. He's a member of the National Center of Supercomputing, and he's a faculty member at Penn State, but he belongs to the Cyprus Institute. And so he's a very typical person. He's a person we have to keep in mind as we think about what does support for faculty need to look like. So our unstated assumption in American higher education tends to be that our students and our faculty are going to rely mainly on their campus for their support, but in fact they're not doing that. They're drawing their support from all over the place, and they may have actually multiple campuses, each thinking that they can provide the totality of the experience. And that unstated assumption is what makes it very, very hard for us to get a truly fresh look at IT support. So, what changes would we make if we were going to start with a blank sheet of paper? I mean a really blank sheet of paper. If we start with the assumption that academic work of all kinds needs to draw on social relationships and technical resources from all over the world, what would we want? This is essentially what four deans and two assistant deans described back to me when I asked this question to them. I had formed them as a steering committee for our institutional change initiative known as IT at Illinois. And this is the vision statement that they came up with. Make every student, every teacher, every researcher the center of their own boundless network of social and technical resources. And that sounds a lot different from how we usually think about support. It doesn't say anything about limiting expectations to what we think we can successfully do. And it doesn't say anything about being clear about who has the right to use our services or not. It's a very ambitious goal, and I expect we'll have conversation about it afterwards. We can provide good support by delivering really good, solid services to a well-defined population. But we're not going to be providing great support for the 21st century unless we learn how to do this. Make every student, teacher, and researcher the center of a boundless network of resources coming from anywhere in the world. Now, I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. But we've set a very lofty goal. And what I want to do is to think about, in concrete terms, if we can get there, think about how do we have to organize ourselves in order to begin making progress toward this vision. If great support helps students and faculty connect with resources anywhere in the world, we can't really expect to get great support unless our support personnel are themselves highly connected. When we divide IT support into many different separate groups, not communicating and not connecting, not collaborating and not contributing to one another, the result is likely to be services that also make it hard for students and faculty to connect, collaborate, and co-contribute. And I'll give you just one example of this. We'll come back to some more in a minute. Let's say we want to have a wiki in the College of Engineering, and I have colleagues from my College of Engineering here. It will not be useful for the engineering faculty if the College of Engineering Wiki only allows access to the College of Engineering. I happen to be acutely aware of that myself because I do lots and lots of cross-unit and cross-institutional collaboration, and the wiki we support in my organization is really hard to let people into who are not on the payroll or on the registrar's roll at the University of Illinois. How many of you have your wikis thrown open to any collaborator? I don't see any hands except one. Can that possibly be true, that we all have closed our wikis other than to our own bounded communities? Okay, that's a problem. Now I'm going to show you two kinds of visual metaphors for organization, an org chart and, once again, a social network diagram. And then we're going to come back and reflect on these. First, just a standard organizational chart. I've tried to make this kind of generic. I am modeling it on Illinois, but I tried to remove things that are strictly local. The important thing about this is to look at the arrangement of the shaded boxes throughout the organizational chart. It's definitely not a complete organizational chart, but it does contain an example of most of the structures that you find in an American college or university. There is a central administration layer, and it has some IT support of its own that's just local support, not support that trickles down to the campus through any kind of a service. And then there's some kind of a central IT organization. In our case, it's called Sites. And that service is intended to have customers throughout the campus, both above and below it, and sideways from it through the org chart. But then there's IT staff spread all through the org chart. And I know that a lot of you are thinking that what I'm going to argue here is that the way to solve problems of disconnection in the IT staff is to try to gather all these shaded boxes together. But I don't argue that. I've never argued that. I've always argued against that. And the reason I argue against that is you can't solve a disconnection problem by breaking ties. IT support is spread throughout the org chart this way, because it connects IT to faculty and students. But let's look at the organization in a different way, because the org chart view does point to something that we need to manage, not something we need to fix necessarily, but something we need to manage. And this is a standard network diagram. It looks different from the diagrams I showed you before, although it's generated by the same piece of software. What I've done here is I've removed any kind of information on what this is a network diagram of, so we can just look at structure and not worry much yet about content. But we are going to talk about what this is later. No matter where people sit in an org chart, you can always redraw the organization based on the connections that people have. Now, some of those connections are formal reporting relationships. And in fact, the reason we have formal reporting relationships is to create very, very nice rails along which relational information can run. And very easy ways to form relationships between people who need to be closely related. In this diagram, all the little pale dots are people, and the other dots are different kinds of things that I will explain in a bit. And the lines between the dots indicate various kinds of connections. I've left out something that's normally in a social network diagram. I don't know if anybody will guess what it is, but there are no strictly interpersonal relationships here. That is, no green dots, no information on how green dots are connected. So my colleagues are all sitting here at this, a fifth of our delegation is sitting at this table right here, these five gentlemen, and they all have connections one to another that are personal connections, but I haven't had those drawn into the network diagram any more than those are drawn into the org chart. So what you see in the network diagram here is work relationships, not who knows who and who likes who, like you think of for social network diagrams, but who works with who. And it's still a different diagram than an org chart and tells you a really different thing about the world. Now, I'm going to borrow some ideas from Michael Wesch from his talk on Monday. He pointed out that students are seekers of meaning and identity. Well, surprise, so are all of us. We also want to know, where do we fit in the organization? And what is our place? What are we contributing here? And how does it relate to other people? If a representation of an organization is meant to help us understand what our place is and to help us have a sense of identity and of contribution, then these juxtaposed views of organization, the org chart and the social network diagram, they tell us really different things, don't they? And I want to go back and reflect on them for a moment. So here's the org chart. What are the lessons of the org chart? Well, there's an obvious one. Who to pay attention to? The org chart tells us who's the boss and who do we have to listen to, ultimately? Anybody who has any sense at all not only listens to the boss, but also listens to anybody the boss listens to. But the org chart does tell us to pay attention to boss relationships. Does the chart tell us anything more? We like our silos. Thank you, Debbie. We do like our silos. The org chart tells us to think about things as information is running up and down the chain of command, as it's called. And there's an implicit message in that, similar to the kinds of messages that Michael Wesch described for the classroom and its four walls. The org chart teaches us an incredibly disabling lesson about who needs to connect with whom. Not only are we led to think about ourselves as only needing to listen to the person that we report to and the other people that that person listens to, but we're also given to believe that faculty are contained in the silos as well. That faculty basically are of and in our organization, and that their experience, their support experience, is somewhere in the chart. Okay, now that's not true. We've already seen that that's not true. And students are typically not represented in the org chart at all. They aren't represented as people with whom we relate. They're a whole separate thing, the customers. And that, of course, is definitely not true for the universities. The students are all kinds of things. They have all kinds of relationships to the institution. Now, what lessons are taught by the social network diagram? If we think about this diagram as simply a metaphor for organizing, I'd say first off, just to start, that the diagram tells us that relationships matter and that common work is one source of significant relationships. That's a very important point. This chart also, in its complexity, suggests that anything that connects you to one person through common activity, for example, also connects you to a web of other things going on. Because each person with whom you connect brings with them their connections. And you can see that this is a structural diagram in the terminology of social network analysis. And so you can see that there are separate sort of groups of things that are tightly interconnected and that bridge to one another through relatively narrow paths. And this emphasizes, I've chosen this particular view to emphasize that when a person connects with any other person through some kind of joint activity, they acquire a path to influence both to and from all the other things that that person brings as part of their network of relationships. And so when you connect with another person, they're not only that person, but many others with whom that person connects have a stake in what the two of you decide. And the final lesson that is suggested by the social network diagram that's not suggested by the org chart is that social systems are not under the control of any one person, even in a highly hierarchical organization. It's not assured that the person at the top of the org chart is a heavily connected person, and quite often the person at the top of the org chart is not a heavily connected person. So this requires a shift in our thinking about support that doesn't have anything to do with moving people around in the yard chart, but has everything to do with getting over the idea that the things that we do locally can be a total experience for our customers. My central argument today is that to support our highly connected students and faculty, we ourselves need to value connection, and we need to learn how to do a better job of connecting. We need to learn how to work within virtual teams and virtual organizations. And I like the term delocalizing for this, to describe the process of trying to rethink support so that it's not attached to a specific location in space or in an organizational logic. And this sounds quite abstract, but it has a lot of very practical consequences. I'll give just three examples to illustrate what I mean. Login credentials and access restrictions. Our tendency within our legacy support methods is to try to treat each service that we provide as potentially having its own methods for managing access through specific login credentials issued for the service, and by using organizational membership, such as presence on a payroll or presence on a registration list, as the basis for granting access to the resource. Those are practices that make perfect sense from a certain point of view. But when you start thinking about the needs of people as needs to connect to their own networks of personal and social resources, it suddenly makes no sense at all. Desktop support, doing different things in every location within a university campus is fine if everybody on your campus only has one workplace. If many of your faculty move from office to office, and that is in fact a very normal pattern for 21st century faculty, then having a lot of special protocols, a lot of special policy, and a lot of special technologies in one of their many offices is not really enabling their work. And that's something that you realize once you realize that the person entering your workplace brings with them all of their other associations. So I have in mind a couple of colleagues. One is a professor of civil and environmental engineering, and she has three roles, pretty much like I do. She's a faculty member in her department. She is an associate provost fellow, so she has both an office and support within the provost office, and she's a fellow of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and part of their leadership team. So she's also got that whole world to deal with. And those are three very different worlds, three very different support environments. The fact that when she goes to the provost office, she has to use all of the odd arrangements that have built up around serving VIPs, that's not helpful for her. That's an obstacle to getting her work done. And my other example is my own colleague in my own department, Christian Sandvig. He's a student of media and media effects. And he's connected all over campus. He's got affiliations in four different colleges. I don't think he has four different offices, but he's around the campus all the time. He's affiliated in the College of Engineering, the College of Arts and Sciences, the College of Media, and the College of Library and Information Science. And in addition to that, he's a fellow of the Berkman Center at Harvard. So his connections are not just all over the campus, but way beyond that. And so the idea that you can contain Christian's experience and provide him a support environment that's good for him by adopting a set of practices special for the Department of Communication, that's just wrong. Christian isn't well served by that, no matter how good the service is. And then finally, we'll talk about the student experience. We all have the idea in mind, and I hear it all the time because of one of my own particular soapboxes, that what students really need is a consistent instructional environment. And that's the rationale for having one standard course management system, whether that's at the scale of a department, a college, or a campus. Well, what lesson are we teaching students about learning by giving them one way to experience all of the complexity of connected digital information? Now, let's talk a little bit about IT at Illinois. That's been my consuming project for 2.5 years now. And its most impressive result so far has been identifying about $10 million in cost savings for the campus. But cost savings wasn't the primary goal of IT at Illinois, and it hasn't been its most important effect on the campus either. As I mentioned earlier, our primary goal with IT at Illinois has been to try to transform the support environment, to bring it up to date for how we think students and faculty work now. And we're making slow but steady progress on that agenda. But there's something else very, very important here, and that is the transformation of the IT support community. There are about 24 people from Illinois here. We have more people here in attendance than in any other institution, so I'm told, followed closely by Wisconsin, Milwaukee. and of our delegation, nearly half comes from organizations that don't work for me. We have people here from the College of Engineering, from the College of Arts and Sciences, from housing, from social work and College of Fine Arts, from the library, and from veterinary medicine, and I don't know who all else. I hope I didn't miss anybody. But part of what's happened at IT at Illinois is that the tasks that have been set in the course of trying to transform support for the faculty and students has also had an effect on us and how we think about our allegiance to the campus and to one another. The way the initiative has a goal, but it also has a method. And the method has been all about creating peer-to-peer connections and helping us to become a totally connected community. Now let's go back to the network diagram view of things. And this is a view of the work that's been done for IT at Illinois. Social network diagrams usually have people in them, and this one will in a minute. But right now, I want to show you just the activities that have surrounded this change initiative. And they come in all different types. The nodes in the diagram, which I've labeled just for the moment, are all different kinds of things. Part of the work that we've done has been to do studies and then to write documents that lay out recommendations. And that's a common feature of initiatives like this. We've developed governance groups, and those are shown in the diagram as well. And we've taken on actual IT projects, and those too are shown as nodes in the diagram. You can make a social network diagram out of almost any social system. So the fact that there are no people in here yet, that's just a fact about what I've chosen to show. And you can see that not only are most of the activities directly connected to the idea of IT at Illinois, shown at the center here, but also many of the activities are connected to one another. For example, I've tried to represent here how a report done by a study group led to a project, and that's been a very common pattern within our initiative. As in any social network diagram, the lines do represent relationships between nodes, but what the nature of the relationship is changes depending on the pair of nodes being connected. If a document is connected to a project, that usually means that the document made a recommendation for the project, and then the project implemented the recommendation. And those details aren't too important, but I just mention it so that you know that this diagram has some logic to it and is based on, in fact, real events. The nodes that are represented there, there are too many of them to list, but what I've done is I've pulled out just a few of the more practical things that have been done by IT at Illinois. And you can see that there's nothing very surprising here as far as trying to update IT services goes. We have a unified communications project underway, and we'll have transitioned entirely to centrally provided unified communications by summer of 2012. But behind that was a grassroots effort to try to get a Microsoft Campus Agreement, a separate effort to try to get Exchange services all over campus consolidated into one, and a longstanding goal of trying to get us off of Centrex as the provider of our voice telephone services. So IT at Illinois somehow allowed these three things to come together in a single big project that actually is going to be pretty transformative for faculty, giving them much more control over their communication platforms and much greater control over the presence they project to the rest of the world. We are working on data center consolidation, as many people are. We have a project underway to try to gather our fragmented web development and web support resources. I'm going to talk in a minute about the Center for Media Excellence. I'll just say now that it's a virtual center, not something in the org chart, never going to be in the org chart. We have a student support development team, and that came from long engagement with students themselves that allowed us to see that the way we were connecting, we as an institution, the way we were connecting with students as individuals was being read by them as complete disregard for their time and effort. They called to our attention that their connections with the institution were mostly carried out through manual paper processes where they'd walk around from office to office to get signatures on things. And we decided that that was teaching the wrong lesson about their relationship to us and our relationship to them. So we're fixing that. At the bottom of the list are two things that go directly to research support. Our new program to try to define new support roles specifically around connecting. We call this our Research Technology Facilitator Program. And we also have a shared research cluster being stood up for the first time on the campus at Illinois. We've had a shared cluster for some time in the College of Engineering, but have never before actually tried to stand up a shared cluster that any researcher on campus could buy into. And so those things have all come from the greater connectedness that we've achieved. Now, but the interesting thing about all this is not the specific consolidation projects we've done. It's how we went about this, where these ideas came from, who did them, and what social results came about afterwards. This is the same set of activities. I have changed the visualization algorithm to show them a little differently. But the main and most important difference here is that I've added the people, and mostly those are the dots that run around the perimeter of the diagram. I took out the labels not only to remove clutter, but also because I didn't want Chuck or Mike or Robert to see their name up here on the screen all of a sudden. So the dots have been anonymized, and when I anonymized the dots, I also had to anonymize all the projects. And what this allows you to see is how all of the activities that are part of the IT at Illinois initiative have attracted people and have become common links between person and person as they work on the activities. Now, the activities have value in and of themselves. For example, we're getting unified communications. We're decommissioning a lot of wasted data center space and so on. But the really important thing about the activities is how they've built us into a community, a connected, collaborating, co-contributing community. Now, some of the activities have just been groups getting together and writing papers. In the early days of IT at Illinois, the provost and I simply threw the doors open and invited anyone on our campus to submit ideas for things we could do to try to update our support environment. Within a couple of months, we'd gotten 70-some papers, more than 70, I think 73, with ideas ranging from we ought to just use less paper, all the way up to we should really try to rethink our whole governance framework and everything that follows down below. So the papers were really diverse, and they were just whatever people had on their minds, 70 of them. And then those papers began to attract adherents. And those adherents formed into work groups in many cases. Not all the papers, and this is very, very important. Some of the ideas that were in the 70 papers weren't promising ideas, either not good ideas to begin with or not good ideas for the time. And those ideas simply didn't get picked up in this community forming around the idea of trying to do something better. But the ideas that did have merit easily attracted adherents. And we still have some ideas that simply haven't found their right time. But I want to give you one example where it took quite some time for the thing to take off. But now that it's taken off, it's become very, very important. And that is the Center for Media Excellence. The first white paper written on digital media was contributed on the very first day that IT at Illinois was launched, and it was contributed by one of our colleagues who's since moved to University of Wisconsin-Madison, Brian McNerlin. He contributed a paper called Digital Media, and along with a group of colleagues that were known as the Multimedia Users Group. And about 16 versions later, this had evolved into a paper called Time, the Illinois Media Engine. Well, it took another 15 months after that before the group finally decided that if anyone was ever going to do anything with the ideas in their paper, it was going to be them. And all of a sudden, on a certain day, the group that had been developing these ideas declared the Center for Media Excellence into existence. They went to a thing we call the caffeine break and did a presentation in front of all the people who happened to turn up that day and said, on this day, we're declaring this into existence. And what's remarkable about that is that at Illinois, we've gotten so used to virtual organizations that overnight, Center for Media Excellence has become a fixture in our environment. We treat it very seriously. It is an organization. It is going to do real work for the campus. It has real people associated with it. It's working toward providing certain services we don't have now, and it's never going to be in the org chart. Now, multiply the Center for Media Excellence story by about 12 or even more, because there's still ideas that are working out there. On the whole, people are considering IT at Illinois a success because it's been able to identify permanent cash savings for the campus, big ones. And that's one of the things that we were after. But what I like about IT at Illinois is what it suggests about the possibility that we are changing how we change. What we're seeing is that organizational change can in fact be very, very rapid. It doesn't have to be the kind of thing that we associate with giant change efforts that first have to get everyone's buy-in and then have to work out all the details of how you're going to transfer people from place to place. The most interesting thing about IT at Illinois is the reliance on self-organizing groups. And basically, the way that I directed this thing pretty much from the beginning was pretty straightforwardly right out of Clay Shirky's playbook. So if you've read Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organization, what we did with IT at Illinois is precisely what Clay Shirky describes. And he boils it all down to a little recipe that I've reproduced here on the screen. You can count on self-organizing groups to get something done when you have three elements in place. A promising idea, and we had a huge pool of ideas, not all promising, but a substantial minority of those ideas were in fact promising enough to attract people around them. Okay, you have to have some kind of a tool that enables people to coordinate their work and their effort toward whatever the idea is. We provided the wiki, and we provided a number of other enablements that allowed people to very rapidly form teams and to come forward with projects that nobody asked them to do. And then the last element that Sharkey mentions is the bargain. And what he means by that is people will join self-organizing groups and give it their best effort when they understand what it is they have to contribute and what happens to their contribution after they give it. Okay, so this isn't about an incentive. This is about an understanding about how your work is going to be treated. And we've had a special bargain all the way through IT at Illinois. The bargain is the person with the idea gets to carry it all the way through. And by the way, there are multiple illustrations of this sitting in the room, but I'll recognize Chuck Thompson, who's the CIO of our College of Engineering. He was, from the beginning, the ringleader of the exchange consolidation study. And years later, he, not someone in my own reporting organization, leads the governance for the Unified Communication Project. And that's a very important element of the bargain. It has meant that people can step up and show leadership, and they personally gain identity, reputation, and stature from what they've done. The network diagram view that I show here for you is a diagram that I built on a single individual, and I'm not going to say who it is, but it's a person who wasn't in a management role, or not a high management role like you'd expect for somebody who would take on themselves leadership. And what I've done is I started with that person's direct connections to projects that he led. And then I've added links around that to other people who were involved in those projects, and then their links. So this is about two or three links deep around one person. But by being very busy and by pushing his own ideas, by stepping up to do things that nobody else was interested in doing, this individual has emerged as a real leader on campus. And anyone on campus who knows anything about IT knows his name. So our framework allows individuals to build their own careers as they build connections and do things for the campus. The rising importance of virtual organizations is at this point completely unmistakable. They are important for our customer base. They're equally important for us. I'm not going to pretend that a virtual organization is better in every way than our conventional ways of thinking about organization. Virtual organizations can be dysfunctional in precisely the same way that formal organizations can be. But there are things that you can do to try to make them better, just like there are with any other organization. You can, for one thing, try to have a very large design repertoire. Don't try to make all virtual organizations exactly the same. But when you need certain kinds of features, use them. If you need a formal charter, if you need a formal memorandum of understanding, add those things. And most importantly, virtual organizations really do profit from transparency, but we all know that that's also true for any other organization we belong to. We all want it. A virtual organization can be small and transient, or it can be large and durable. A good example from our community is the Kuali organization. It has quite a formal structure, involving not only a foundation that owns the intellectual property and that is the primary governance function, but also a whole structure of differentiated governance bodies, stakeholder bodies, and actual workers. I'm going to end with just a couple of observations, and the diagram now is here just to just to give you something to look at. The first observation is that being connected really does amplify your value within your organization. Each person with whom you connect doesn't just get you, but they get everything you're connected to. So the more connected you get, the more you bring to the table. And that's very, very important. It's one of our starting premises for the Research Technology Facilitator Program. We're trying to get those people really connected, not only to other people, but also to worldwide cyber infrastructure resources. But the second observation I want to make is that having a whole lot of connected people makes the whole organization more agile, better able to stop on a dime and do things differently. Formal relationships among people and formal reporting lines are hard to change. And when you do change them, relationships still have to be built. Even though you've created the rails that the relationship can ride on, you still have to build the relationship. There's no shortcutting that. Once you have developed a connected organization, it really does become ridiculously easy to reorganize for new tasks and for new work. And once you've gotten used to this ridiculously easy form of organizing, anything else just looks ridiculously difficult. And I think I can take some questions. Mark? Okay, so the question is, what do we think of the model of having one large IT organization for the campus as a whole? And we've seen that that can be very, very successful. For example, at University of Indiana, there's quite a centralized IT organization that has a really good set of compacts with all of the campuses and does a very, very good job of supporting Indiana. But I don't think that we have to do that in order to achieve connectedness. There are many, many other ways to achieve connectedness. And it's very significant to me that at Indiana, where IT centralization has succeeded better than any other university I know, we also have the primary drivers of what people nowadays call above-campus services, trying to actually really delocalize IT by doing it at a level that that isn't tied to any particular org chart, whether it be the campus level, whether it be the college level, or whether it be the department level. So almost any org chart can work okay for a university, but only if the org chart is a framework around which connections are allowed to build, not if it becomes the only path to connecting person to person. Excellent question. The question is, when somebody comes up with an idea and it starts to look like it has promise, how does it get shepherded through governance, essentially, and resourced, eventually? And I could ask anybody in the room to answer that, I think. There's a long, long period in any project like this where you're simply trying to get to the point where we all agree on what it is we should do. But once you've reached that point where, for example, we all agree that we really ought to have a Microsoft campus agreement and not have everybody buying their own Microsoft products, there's still the problem of how to get that into a decision to do it and a direction to somebody to do it. And the work involved in that is no different from the work involved if we were to have started the process by saying, okay, we want to try to decide whether we should do this. We're going to appoint this group to do it. At the point where the experts agree that what we should do is go down this path, you still have to take it to somebody who's got resources and persuade them that it's a good deal. What's been different here is the IT community has actually taken responsibility for wrestling with these problems and trying to think where the resource is going to come from. Microsoft Campus Agreement is a very good example. I have, as one of my close circles of colleagues, what we call our Council of Academic CIOs, one per college. And after we'd formed the intention to have the Microsoft Campus Agreement, we spent a couple of months trying to actually turn over rocks looking for money for where we were going to find the cash to do this. In the final analysis, we persuaded the provost's office that the advantage of this was so great that sites should be allowed to go into deficit to do this for the campus and then earn back the money to pay back the deficit through the savings we would achieve in other ways. So there isn't any sort of throttle at the front end for what ideas can be developed, but there's no harder path to get into governance for ideas that come up from the grassroots than there is for things that come down from the top. In fact, I have to say, now that I'm reflecting on it, that the projects that have bubbled up through IT at Illinois have been somewhat more likely to get funded than things that have come from provost-appointed blue ribbon committees. No. Well, yes and no. The question was, what happens to the savings? Do they get earmarked for innovative things? Wow, that's such a good question. We could have a whole session on that, on our philosophies about that, for example. I think it's quite natural to say, why should I look for the savings if I'm not going to get to use them for something that I myself value? Well, part of our problem has been to, as a community, to embrace the goal of trying to control the cost of higher education. So returning savings to the campus is part of our goal here. But we are also saving our own time. With the Microsoft Campus Agreement, one of the big savings was the time of the IT staff. And the value there is that we've been able to use our surplus to do whole new things like research technology facilitation. So we do get to do new things with our time, but the money we save is going back to the campus to reduce our cost. I don't know if people know this, but, and I'm probably not supposed to say it, but Illinois has really gotten really expensive for students. And so controlling the cost of what an education at Illinois comes to for the students is really, really important. And our community has believed that and embraced it and works to try to achieve that, just like we work to try to achieve technical excellence. Thank you all.
Sally Jackson from the EDUCAUSE 2011 Midwest Regional Conference. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.